Chill Podcast.
Hello and welcome. This is Deepak Jayaraman here, the creator and curator of the Play to Potential podcast series. My guest this time is Ravi Venkatesan, who needs no introduction. He's an alumnus of IIT Bombay, Purdue University, and Harvard Business School. He used to head Cummins in India between 96 and 2003. He then moved to a very different industry and headed Microsoft in India between 2004 and 2012. Now he wears multiple hats ranging across board roles, social impact, venture funding, mentoring entrepreneurs, writing and speaking, just to name a few of the things he does. In our conversation, we spoke about a range of topics, including how one should think about building a career, transitioning across geographies and industries, inflection points in startups, and moving from an executive to non-executive role. A quick background about myself. I'm an executive coach, and I work closely with leaders during periods of organizational or individual transition. For details of what I do, please visit transitioninsight.com. Without further ado, over to the conversation. Ravi, thanks for your time. Excited to be talking to you.
Yeah, me too.
Ravi, just to dive in, you clearly wear multiple hats today. For the benefit of the listeners, it'll be great to get a sense of the different hats you wear. Give us an insight into the different roles you play and things you do.
Gosh, perhaps the best way to describe it is to talk about the things that take the most time, and then describe other things I do. I'd say the single biggest sort of focus right now is Bank of Baroda, where I'm a non-executive chairman. Even though the title says non-executive, the bank is going through a lot of change and challenges, and so I spend quite a bit of time helping build social venture partners is, and the whole million jobs mission.
Right.
I think is another big sort of passion. Then I'm involved with two or three companies in different capacities. I work with Infosys. I work with Raymond.
Sure.
Work with a small company, but reasonably fast-growing company called Urban Ladder. I'm on a couple of advisory boards. So that, taken collectively, is probably a third thing I do. And then I do a fair amount of writing, speaking and teaching. So there's that. Then I'm very involved as a trustee with the Rockefeller Foundation. And we're beginning to do quite a lot of work in India. So that's a piece, important piece of my time and work. What else? I'm involved with organizations like United Seed Fund, where I'm a venture partner. Serve on a couple of small non-profit boards. Mentor a lot of people, all informally. So, yeah, it's a rather
it's
a very diverse set of things. And sometimes even I have trouble keeping track, let alone describing what I do.
Got it. And maybe picking up on the social venture partners piece that you spoke about, given I'm personally involved and I was witness to the energy in the room where we had the conclave in Delhi recently. Talk to us a little bit about this whole million jobs mission and what that's about.
Yeah, first let me talk about social venture partners itself.
Sure.
This is an sort of a 17, 18-year-old organization set up originally in Seattle. But we started it in India in 2013,
right,
as you know. And the whole idea was, how do you get successful people, entrepreneurs, professionals, involved with the communities in which they live so that they become, you know, agents for change and transformation, leaders in society? Because much of the dysfunctional aspects of India, I believe, are because people like all the people who might be listening to your podcast live incredibly private lives and disengage more and more from society. So if we want to create functioning societies, we need good people to be more engaged. And that's why we thought SVP might be an interesting model. And today there are 200 partners in five cities. We obviously decided that we needed to sink our teeth into something that is, you know, common purpose. And we said, given what's going on in India today, the issue of jobs, or more precisely livelihoods, is a good one for us to try and make some dent in. And so we set ourselves, without knowing exactly how we were going to achieve it, this audacious target of, can we improve the incomes of 1 million people in a significant way by 2020.
Right.
We actually put that stake in the ground in 2015, and here it is already 2017. So that's what we're all about, and we've been doing lots of experiments on how exactly we have this kind of impact, and now we are converging more and more on the idea that solving such an intractable or wicked problem at such scale requires all stakeholders to come together in a collaborative fashion around a common purpose, common mission, an idea called collective action.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to see if SVP could be the platform
mm-hmm.
for this kind of a mission. Right. Did I answer your question?
No, that makes sense, Ravi. That sort of segues to the first piece I want to talk about, which is about leadership in the social impact world. And again, social impact is a pretty loosely used term. But a lot of people are transitioning from the corporate world, leaders from the corporate world, and are trying to make a dent, to use your phrase, in the social impact world. What have been some of your observations on the transition they need to make, or how's the leadership in the social world different from what you've experienced in the for-profit world?
As you said, a lot of people out there with good intentions.
Right.
And as you begin to feel successful as you get older, there's that desire, that need to actually, you know, contribute to something bigger than yourself. I think that's a really wonderful phenomenon that's growing stronger around the world and certainly in India. The challenge is it's not always evident how to make a difference and what your leverage points are.
Yeah.
I think the social sector, from, you know, I'm no expert on it, but based on 5 years of thinking about these issues, fundamentally different in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, in a company, the success metrics are, you know, quite clear and well defined. You know, it's revenue, your bottom line, blah blah blah. Whereas in a social problem, it's far more complex, and defining what success looks like,
right,
let alone measuring it and attributing success, are far more difficult to quantify. Therefore, it becomes sometimes harder to mobilize people, and certainly very, very hard to hold people accountable.
Mm.
The second issue is one of resources. There's much less abundance.
Mm.
And so you have to have you have to be very frugal and very creative in how you're going to leverage resources.
Mm-hmm.
You can't pay people as much, and therefore you've got to figure out what is the value proposition that's going to attract bright, passionate people to work on these kinds of problems. Very frankly, sometimes you also get people who are not necessarily the most accomplished people, and yet there's a lot of passion, and how do you inspire them, motivate them? They're doers. So the ways in which you lead and manage are quite different.
Hmm.
What else is different? I think there's almost nothing you can accomplish on your own. You have to work with a whole set of players, civil society, companies, and government. And so you need to be a really high EQ person if you're going to, you know, form trust-based relationships with an incredibly diverse set of people to come together. They have, you know, and inherently, I think we live in an environment of low trust and declining trust.
Mm.
So this is an interesting challenge. And the worst thing you can do is come in there as a know-it-all. I've seen how it works in the corporate sector. I'm here to help. And then you hear the sound of crashing China, the China shop phenomenon. And very often, people from the corporate sector, with all good intentions, end up making that mistake.
And actually, even maybe reflecting on which cause to contribute to.
Yeah.
In a country like India, especially, where there's no shortage of problems to solve, how did you think about figuring out which problems to go after?
Yeah, the beauty of India is there are lots of things you can do. And so in a sense, it really doesn't matter which cause you pick. You have to pick something that you care about and you're passionate about.
Right.
And when we started thinking about SVP, the set of people who were in the room, you know, gravitated towards jobs and livelihoods. And so it wasn't like there was some big scanning that we did and said which sectors are the most important or neglected. No, it was where our collective passion was, and I'd say that's probably the most important thing. The other important thing is once you decide where you're going to play the theater, you do have to bring systems thinking to it. Because otherwise what you're doing very likely is just putting little band-aids around issues. And maybe that's also necessary and helpful, but certainly it's not going to prevent problems from persisting. So if you really want to make a difference, you need to be able to have a worm's eye view and the bird's eye view and go back and forth. But you need that ability to see the whole system and the interrelationships and linkages and figure out where the leverage points are.
Right. I want to rewind the clock now, Ravi, maybe going back to your growing up years. Again, if you had to say three things that formed you as a person as you grew up, let's say till the end of education, they still form a core part of who you are. Any themes that show up?
Certainly. I think it's that early childhood programming that actually persists in a very, very profound way. I think the single most important influence in my life was my mother, not surprising. But from her, she instilled me in a desire to excel and be successful. And I've not been able to soften that conditioning very, very much at all. So whatever I do, I try to pour all of myself into it and try and excel. So that's been a lasting one. Second is, fairly early again, I realized I wasn't the brightest person in the room. And the way I compensated for that is I worked harder than almost anybody else. So, and even today, whatever I do, I really do burn the candle at both ends in the middle. So that's a important part of sort of growing up influences. A third one would be just because of my family and the people who were friends of the family. I grew up as a very curious boy, and there was a year where I had to drop out of school for medical reasons, and it was the best year because we lived in Chandigarh near a big state library. And so every day I'd totter over to the library and come back with books that were way ahead of me and way through at least one book a day. Wow. One book a day, just not really sort of reading every word. And so I grew up with profound curiosity, and not just a narrow curiosity, a boundless curiosity. I think that has served me fairly well.
Especially in the digital world where just... there's so many moving pieces. I'm sure the curiosity can be handy. Moving back to a point in time, again, if we were to reflect on the point you graduated from IIT Bombay, again, with the wisdom of the career and the journey and the experiences you've had, if you were graduating from IIT Bombay today, how would you think about life ahead in the career?
If I were graduating from anywhere, period, you know, IIT or not, I think you have to realize that the world is changing rapidly, that the era of stable jobs, careers, etc., is almost over. Okay, and you know, when I was graduating from business school, on the last day, we had a little class on how to think about your career. And the professor stood up and said, listen, forget about lifetime employment. Already a Harvard Business School grad has 2.5 jobs in their career. And so by the time you guys, you know, get to, you know, blossom, it's probably going to be 4 jobs. That feels kind of ridiculous today. And with automation and outsourcing and the gig, you know, the marketplace, all those kinds of ideas, I think you have to say, my life is not about a career or a job, but rather a series of gigs or projects. And if 3 or 4 of these gigs end up in the same organization, so be it. But if it's across organizations, so you need to frame your future professional life in a fundamentally different way. Okay, rather than one smooth, long highway ahead of you, you have to be prepared for lots of interesting and uncertain experiences.
And it's interesting, you're decoupling the experience from the organization.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
It could be a coincidence, but it could not be.
Yeah, if it is one organization, it's a coincidence, and you should be grateful for that. But as a result of this, you need to be prepared to be an entrepreneur or at the very least self-employed.
Hmm.
Okay? You need to have the confidence and the skills to be able to put food on the table and fend for yourself, rather than dependent on an organization to feed you and take care of you, which means you better be really good at something and around which you can build your professional life and economics. And the second thing is you need to cultivate your professional reputation very intentionally. Most people today don't put any conscious thought into it, and therefore if they have a reputation, it's an accident. I think people have to become far more intentional about it.
By doing what?
No, so first thing is by being excellent. Okay? There is no room, I think, or less and less room for mediocrity. So you have to be excellent at whatever you choose to do. And word will spread. You have to be dependable. You have to be, you know, a pretty reasonable integrity person. So first of all, you have to focus on, you know, being a decent and competent professional, and then make sure that that reputation is known, at least in the relevant circles. So I think conscious management of your professional reputation is going to be more and more important. Okay. And with that, high quality networks, not having 1,000 friends on Facebook, that's worth almost zero. But high quality individuals in your network who are portals to other networks.
Sure.
So you have to think about all these things. The last thing I would say is you need to take more risk.
Hmm.
Almost everybody I talk to, when they look back at their life, and the older you get, the more you think about these things, regrets not having taken enough risk. The thing you regret at age 70 is not the risks you took that didn't work out, but the risks you didn't take at all. And you wonder
omissions, right?
The omissions. And so you wonder how life might have played out differently had you taken that road. And so you don't want to be there that way. So right from the beginning, get used to taking on big challenges, being outside your comfort zone, confronting your fears. And I think that's going to be really important as you get into a more and more complex, volatile, uncertain kind of world.
And actually, picking up on that, Ravi, if I may talk about a certain tension, going back to my days as a search consultant, there's something to be said about being in a company long enough so that you've seen a cross-cycle view,
yeah.
So that you've built the resilience to see the ups and downs. But at the same time, given the velocity of change, there's stuff being thrown people's way at a much higher frequency. So how do you sort of deal with that tension of sticking long enough to ensure that you're resilient while responding to stuff that comes your way? How do you think about that?
So I don't know how. I can only say how I've thought about it. I don't know that this is a prescription for anyone else.
Sure.
But I've thought about every role I've gotten to with the idea of what is the legacy I'm going to leave behind. And so almost everything I've done has been about a 5 to 7 year long gig. And funnily, for the first few years of that gig, both I and the world thought I was going to fail.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it's only by being resilient, tenacious, and, you know, seeing through all sorts of challenges that eventually you get to a point where you feel satisfied that you left something durable, enduring,
mm-hmm.
and others did too. So I feel that the right way to go about it is probably in the beginning of your professional life, do lots of things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that means you might move every year, 2 years. But by the time you reach late 20s, you need to think about staying long enough to build something enduring, leave a legacy. And so the career path, in that sense, looks like not lots of little steps every 2 years, but much bigger steps every 5 or 7 years.
Right.
I think that, and so even though the world is becoming more turbulent and stuff flying at you from every direction, you still need, I think that's still important to be able to weave Duck Bob and build something impressive.
Hmm. Great. So give us an insight into transitioning to India. Again, you, in your case, you come from India, you started out in India, but I see a lot of general managers being planted into India. And
yeah.
I see, again, there are some that succeed, some that are less successful. So in your point, in your mind, what are the common failure modes of people coming into India from a different market?
I came back to India in 1996, partly because India had gone through economic liberalization in 1991.
Yeah.
And I said, wow, something different going on. And I've never worked there, so it'll be fun to spend at least some time there.
Mm-hmm.
The other reason is my parents were aging and I wanted to be a little bit closer to them as they were going through some medical issues. I never intended to come back for good.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, for the first 3 years, I left all my things in storage in the U.S. And one quarter at a time, I would pay for to extend the storage.
You had a hedge.
I had a hedge because I wasn't sure how long things were going to work. And I'd come in as the CEO at the age of 32 of a failing joint venture with Tata Motors. And the environment I stepped into was extremely hostile because the two partners, Cummins and Tata Motors, were at loggerheads. And there was a very powerful feudal leader at Tata Motors, a man who just died called Vinod Rawal. And he looked at me and said, you've never worked, you're 32 years old, you're more American than you're Indian. And he was quite hostile. And I realized that somehow winning his trust was central to my success and that of the JV. Just an instinct. So I just focused on being humble and cultivating a sort of an elder brother, younger brother relationship with him. And I thought that was important. So understanding instinctively, only now can I, in retrospect, can I go back and rationalize these things. Understanding stakeholders and who matters and managing that was, just survival instinct. The second piece was you better be a fast learner. If you're going to do transitions, and I think today you're forced, whether you like it or not, to make these transitions every so often. I think we have to be very agile in learning about new environments and new situations. And so I sort of was quite a fairly quick study. Third thing is tenacity. Everything in India is going to take much longer than you ever, think it will. So what should happen in 1 year will likely take 3 or 4 years. So you just got to hang in there, and then one day it all pops and you're rewarded. So those are some of the things I did. But I think a general sense of humility goes a long way in all these transitions.
True. And I think picking up from one of the chapters in your book, Conquering the Chaos, where you talk about why or how leading in India can be different from leading in some of the other markets. Give us an insight into, from a leadership perspective, how do you sort of nuance your leadership style in India?
No, there's some things you've got to realize are quite different. First, India is a much more volatile and turbulent environment. I mean, just take demonetization. And this sort of stuff is fairly routinely happening. And so as a leader of an organization, you just have to be far more agile and resilient at the same time
mm-hmm.
than you would in a developed market where things are much more stable and predictable, although they're becoming more like us. The second thing that is different is people capabilities are still quite modest. Because remember, India opened up only in 91, so it's hardly been 25 years since we really had open business environment and talent started learning how to operate in this environment. So in contrast to, let's say, a Germany or the US or Sweden, the depth of talent is quite modest yet, although it's improving.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a leader, you have to teach a lot, and you can't get impatient, and you can't just assume people will do things the way you wish. So you have to be leading from the front, you have to be teaching a lot, and it's action learning, and you've got to be endlessly tough and patient. And so that style is quite different, I think. The third thing is you have to engage emotionally with your people. I think that is far more important in several cultures, including our culture. People expect that, and they respond well to an emotional engagement. And you can't be this distant, aloof, transactional leader. I don't think that works anywhere, but certainly it doesn't work too well out here. So these are some of the, I think, challenges of our environment.
And picking up on one of the themes you alluded to, Ravi, which is leading people who are much older than you. And if I specifically reflect on the developments in the, let's say, startup ecosystem, yeah, as the companies grow, there comes a point where you need to get experienced people to run functions or run BUs. What are some of the lessons in making them work with you and driving towards what you're trying to achieve?
Again, I was very conscious of the fact that I was, when I started out my career, I was very often the youngest person in the room, at least till I turned about 40. And
you were 35 when you were chairman of Cummins.
Yeah, and it was big because, again, 1998, 99, there weren't that many big listed companies.
Mm.
And to be the chair of one of those was considered a big deal. Today, that's sort of incredibly common. I think the most important thing is treat people with respect. And it's particularly important if you've got somebody older reporting to you. I think there's an expectation. India's still that way, I think, conscious of age and so forth.
Mm.
So respect goes a long way. But most of all, whatever issues they may have following a younger person, if you're passionate about what you do, if you're competent at what you do, you listen to their ideas and treat them with respect. So all these things about gender, age, all these things tend to vaporize very quickly, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Today I'm on the opposite end, right? I'm usually leading people much younger.
Fair enough. Any lessons? On getting them to listen to you?
Well, one of the things I do is I expect them, I formally tell them, I need you to teach me X.
Mm.
So there was there's a young entrepreneur, you know, advising, helping or whatever. And I said, listen, I need you to teach me about Bitcoin.
Mm.
And he sort of assumed that, oh, a guy from Microsoft, board of Infosys, chairman of some bank, surely you're joking, aren't you? I said, no, I really need you to explain this to me in detail.
Mm.
And then they really love it.
It's a great point. I guess there's an opportunity for both sides. Right?
Jack Welch was particularly very good at this. He used to say every business leader in GE in the 90s
mm-hmm.
needs to have a formal mentor who is much younger, teaching them about technology and digital and all those sorts of things.
Moving on, Ravi, after a long stint in Cummins, you moved on to take the leadership role in Microsoft in India. Give us an insight into how one could transition across industries effectively with the wisdom of hindsight.
I was very nervous about that shift because the only place I'd ever worked in was Cummins.
Hmm.
And I'd worked my way up, so it was very much my home. And I was leaving home and I was also moving to a profoundly different industry against all the advice of my friends and family and mentors. Whether it was my mom or whether it was Nandan Nilekani, they said, don't do this, it's going to end badly. Because you don't understand technology. Microsoft is a super tough transactional culture. You're a relationship guy. And so, you know, it was a tough decision. And I remember thinking that, okay, I'm 40 now. If I don't do this now, when? And when I turn 50, which will I regret more? Having joined Microsoft and got fired, or having been too timid to even take it on. And I said, I'll feel worse with the latter. So let me go. But again, let me frame it not as a job, but as a project.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't know how long it'll last. It ended up lasting 8 years. Now, what did I do that helped in retrospect? I think the first thing is I was very conscious I didn't know anything about the industry. And so I listened a lot. In fact, I remember when in my interview process, I got interviewed by Bill Gates, who used to then interview every person Microsoft hired. Mm-hmm. And so I said, Bill, I must be frank. I think you can find a better qualified person. I don't understand technology and all. He said, that's great. Maybe you listen. Mm-hmm. And he was exactly right. So I listened a lot before making up my mind. And I think that was really helpful because it was a very arrogant culture at that point in time. That The second thing I realized is that the team we had was high on enthusiasm and low on maturity. Mm-hmm. And so I had to build a very new team, a much better team, much faster, incredibly quickly. And I think that was really helpful. So as you make these transitions, quickly figure out who's on the bus, who's off the bus, and then get a core team of committed people around you. Mm-hmm. Because on your own, it's pretty tough. Mm-hmm. Third thing was, again, stakeholder management. What I realized is at the end of the day, Bill and Steve were still pretty hands-on. And this is therefore, in many sense, a Lala company. Mm-hmm. It might have been a $30 billion company, but it was still very promoter-driven in an Indian sense. Mm-hmm. So it's important that the promoters like you.
Yep.
And the rite of passage in Microsoft was you needed to take on Bill and Steve. And it didn't matter whether you won or lost the argument, but the courage to stand up and hold your ground was a rite of passage. Mm-hmm. And so within 9 months of my joining the company, I made sure that we found an issue where I took a stance and, and they, and once you, that moment is over, you're in the good books. And if you're perceived to be in the good books of Bill, whether you are or not, the organization tends to be very much more supportive. So I think you have to decode the culture of an organization, who really matters, and learn how to navigate all that. Performance matters. At the end of the day, whichever organization you're in, fairly quickly if you start performing and your unit starts performing, I think a lot of things fall in place. So I remember, again, the year I joined, Microsoft was handing out bonuses for growing 14%. And I was shocked because I came from Cummins, which is a diesel engine business, which was growing faster. So I said, this is the Hindu rate of growth. And the very first year, we took it to some 28%. And year three was 35%. Year four was 45%. So, there's a certain thing about performance, which, really does earn you a lot of credibility and space to operate. So I'd say, these were some of the things.
And picking up on the first piece, listening, again, if I reflect on the velocity of change in the world we live in and the number of different situations where leaders come in with into evolving environments with limited understanding of what the right answer is. Again, could you double click on what is listening? How do you listen? Where do you listen to really come up to speed on the situation?
Yeah, so as you know, that about 18 months ago, I took on a completely new role as the chairman of a public sector bank.
Right.
Now, I know nothing about banking, and I know even less about public sector. But yet, Raghu and Raghuram Rajan and Jayan Sinha felt that it was important that I take it on, so I did. Now, what do you do in this situation? And you know that the place is filled with landmines and you can step on anything and without realizing it and get blown up. So what you have to do is listen intently. And I did. I made it a very conscious effort to listen to a bunch of people, retired chairman of the Bank of Baroda. Okay, so help me understand from your perspective, what I should do, what the issues are, how would you handle them?
Hmm.
You get a certain perspective. I went and spoke to Vaghul of ICICI and PJ Nayak of Axis Bank, even though they've been around and seen the evolution of the banking sector. I've met a lot of our own employees and so forth. So from this, you begin to piece together first the situation and then out of that emerges a theory of change, which is, what interventions are really going to make a difference and who are going to be the important allies in this. If you don't listen and you come in with a point of view, you start, jumping into action right away, you're going to make a lot of mistakes because you haven't picked built this nuanced and reasonably accurate picture of the landscape. Mm. So, yeah, so I'm very, very intentional about these things.
It's interesting. Again, if I were to persist with this theme, sometimes the organization is used to a leader who is a domain expert, who yeah. knows the space. And sometimes a leader gets appointed from a different world. So while the leader is listening, the organization is judging on a different set of metrics. So how do you balance that tension of building credibility with a team that's measuring you on domain while you're trying to listen and come up to speed?
Yeah, I don't know that I agree that the organization is measuring you on domain. They are measuring you on how is this guy or this gal going to add value. Okay,
hmm.
Now somebody may add value by being the domain expert.
Right.
Okay, and so they quickly come in, they know, they've seen this situation before, like a good doctor, they say do ABC. And somebody like me who comes clueless has to add value in a different way to earn the respect of people. And you've got to figure out what really matters. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So in Microsoft, it was clear why the company had hired me, because it was because we were becoming irrelevant in a country of 1 billion people. And so they wanted not a technology guy, or at least Bill and Steve wanted somebody who understood India. So within 6 months, I said, you know, in order to become relevant, this is what it takes. And here's a set of things we ought to be doing.
Hmm.
And it was plausible. I don't think it was rocket science or brilliant. And they said, great, now go do it. Where's your team? And by the way, here's $1 billion of investment. Go make it happen. And the team in India said, wow, holy cow. You know, this guy really has done an amazing job getting us all this investment. They used to beg for every headcount.
Mm.
And suddenly we had an abundance of riches.
Mm.
That won me credibility. Okay. At the bank, I saw a highly dysfunctional board process in my first board meeting on August 22nd, 2015. I blew up the whole board process. And the very next board meeting, the September board meeting, was done in a profoundly different way. It's done like the way an Infosys would operate or anything like that. And people perceived and felt that experience. The board loved it. And the general managers of the bank sort of saw a better way of operating. And more importantly, they saw, here's a guy who has no formal authority, step up and show leadership. And so, you know, that won me a certain credibility. So you need to pick, like the Gandhiji's salt march.
Mm.
You have to pick something symbolic that really matters to the organization and show courage and leadership around that. And so that's a judgment call. And again, if you're not listening, you won't know what that is.
What to pick up.
Yeah, you'll just shoot and, you know, it may hit or miss.
Moving to the different theme, Ravi, you invest in young companies as part of United Seed Fund. So one thing I'm curious about is, as a venture partner, what do you look for when you invest behind a leader?
It's a great question, and I wish I had the perfect recipe. I think the people that we've bet on and have worked out, they have a few, two or three common characteristics. One is they have incredible passion for their idea. Passion is actually a mild word. They're consumed by that idea. And I think that's an important attribute, because ultimately it's a predictor of whether they're going to
persist.
That brings you to the second quality, which is tenacity. Because no matter, as they say, no matter what your business plan is, that, you know, the probability is almost 100% that it's going to be different. So you need somebody who's going to be tenacious through all the ups and downs of the ride. And so one of the things you need to look at is, in this person's life, short life, where have they demonstrated tenacity? Okay, and it could be in their personal life, it could be in professional life, but that you have to look for that quality. I think the ability to learn quickly is a third thing. So it really is important, because, again, you'll have to pivot multiple times till you find the right formula, model, etc., product market fit, all these things. And so there is no substitute for somebody who is a quick learner. Decisiveness.
And how do you, going back to learning agility, how do you decipher that when you're interacting with a leader?
I think you do it through a conversation, but you see how fast they're able to keep up and track.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is a judgment call.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, by the time we reach our age, you get fairly good at, you know, sizing up a person and say,
smelling it from a distance.
Yeah, are they smart enough? And it's not a hugely high bar, but there is a threshold,
mm-hmm.
which is very important. Okay, because a lot of people are just a little slow. And that doesn't mean they aren't great, they're good followers, or whatever. But for the entrepreneur, you need to be on the ball. I think speed and decisiveness is another attribute. You can't take forever to make up your mind, you know. You need to be able to run fast.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an important quality. I think the ability to build a team becomes more and more a differentiator. And I find a lot of otherwise competent people just pathetic at being able to. And so what happens to those entrepreneurs is they reach a certain point and then hit a wall and it's unpleasant. So, and again, there's no formula for how you do this, except you look for evidence that they've done something in this space.
And I'm curious about how founders or entrepreneurs evolve as the company grows. And specifically, I like the term you use in the book Conquering the Chaos, hyper-development. Right? Because in a lot of these situations, the rate at which the company grows is often at a much higher pace than typically how the person would grow. So any thoughts on how founders could sort of turbocharge their personal...
Yeah, actually, it's not just for founders. It's for anybody.
True.
In a rapidly changing environment, biggest risk is that the job will outgrow you.
Correct.
Okay, or the incumbent. And how do you prevent that? I think a couple of things. First of all, this idea of learning agility is becoming more and more central.
Mm.
Okay, which is, you have to have curiosity. You have to have the ability to learn new things. And so that's one thing. And you have to. And one of the things that I really, really encourage all the people in all the organizations I work with is, man, just start reading, whether it's a book, internet, whatever, and then develop curiosity. Curiosity is a muscle. The more you do it, the better it gets. That's one. Number two is you have to have self-awareness. And that's really hard. But, and in fact, the more intelligent the person is, the less self-aware they tend to be. Okay, because they're so used to being right and getting a lot of recognition for that. So self-awareness is a hugely important quality. And this is where mentoring comes in. At some point, you're not all born self-aware.
Yeah.
Somebody has to hold up a mirror to your face and say, listen, you know, please take a hard look. See how you're part of the problem, not just... So cultivating self-awareness, becoming more reflective is a huge part of how you make sure that you grow, you know, with the times and the job. I'd say periodically, taking on a challenge which is completely different, stepping way out of your comfort zone and, you know, being successful at it becomes important. That's what I've tried to do every few years. And it gives you self-confidence. It strengthens your ability to learn new things really fast. It, you know, you begin to see patterns and connections across lots of things. I'd say...
Is there an example there in terms of how it played out in your career? The stuff that you took on along the way?
Yeah, no. So, yeah, as as we've discussed, I did Microsoft. Then I went out and became a writer. And I came into contact with lots of companies. Then I did boards. Then I got onto the Bank of Baroda. Then I did Social Venture Partners. And today, as a result, I'm somewhat unique in terms of my ability to think about business, government, civil society, have networks across all these realms, and therefore the ability to connect dots and connect people across these realms. And I think it's a huge competitive advantage if you think about it. And so I think it's very, very helpful for people to periodically completely refresh themselves. What happens otherwise also is that you turn 50, you've done only one thing, the world changes, it's like back to Who Moved My Cheese, and you're fearful and just holding on for dear life, hoping that, you know, you get to retire with dignity. You just see that playing out in so many sort of organizations all over the world. And I think that's really dismal.
And in a company's growth, back to venture funding, one of the other pieces I'm curious about is inflection points in a company's life where the founder needs to hand it over to somebody else, where the founder is not necessarily the most qualified to be the head of the company. So in your experience, what are those lead indicators or things to watch out for?
I wrote a piece on this about letting go being hard for most leaders. I think that, first of all, it's nicer if you let go rather than you being forced to let go. And there are two signs you need to really watch out for. One is it's no longer fun. Okay? And for too many days in a row or months in a row, it's not fun. And then it's an indicator that maybe it's time for you to do something else and somebody more energetic to take your place. The second one is, if you are a self-aware leader, at some point you begin to recognize that you yourself are the biggest bottleneck to the organization's growth and success. At that point you have two choices. Either you change or else you decide, you know, I'm incapable of this change, or at this point in my life, I don't want to make that change, and it's time to go on. So these are the two indicators. And then you really need to, do the right thing and find somebody better to hand the baton to. You know, when I look at my whole professional, 30-year professional life, I take pride in the fact that I chose these transitions. They didn't happen to me. And that every organization did better after I left than they did, you know, under my own stewardship. So I think this is something that I feel pretty decent about. But I think it's fairly exceptional. I don't know. Did I answer your question?
You did. From transitioning from an executive role to a non-exec. And once again, that's an inflection point which a lot of people, again, I do believe what got you here won't get you there applies. So give us an insight into the transition that leaders need to go through from being an effective leader to being an effective non-executive board member.
I think the most important thing to realize is it's no longer about you. Okay? If you're a non-executive chair or whatever, it's now about the CEO. Okay? You're not the most important person in the room or the world. The spotlight is appropriately and needs to be on the executive leader, the CEO or whoever. And your role is actually to do everything within your power to help that person be more successful. Okay? So you have to make that shift. And it's not easy, because for so long it's been about you. And very authoritarian leaders who may have been very successful find it hard to make the shift. Okay? You need to have modest ego, at least be willing to put your ego aside for those moments. Having decided that it's about somebody else's success, you're going to have to think through how you develop that working relationship. It's different if you're the chair and you're working with the CEO.
Yeah.
And it's different if you're simply a board member, non-executive director working with the CEO. The ways in which you influence are completely different. Okay? But as a chair, I think what you need to do is we have the capacity to demonstrate tough love. Okay? which is you have to make it abundantly clear that, and the CEO has to sense that you truly are committed to their success, but you're not unafraid to, you know, hold the mirror up from time to time if that's what's needed. Okay, and hopefully eventually you get into a trust-based relationship, and it's, you know, true pilot, co-pilot, being aware that you're the co-pilot.
Fair. And specifically, a few things that need to be unlearned. Where do you see the failure modes?
Ego. It's very, very hard, actually. Because CEO is very focused on getting things done. I don't care who the CEO is. That's their job, and if they're good, they're very, very focused on getting things done. And sometimes you have a desire to be, you hope, wish that that CEO was more inclusive, truly saw this as a partnership. They're just too busy getting things done. And you can't feel bad about these things. You have to figure out the ways in which you're going to engage with him and the organization in a predictable way. There's a very fine boundary, and you've got to make sure you walk the edge of that boundary line without transgressing it and becoming executive and giving directions and becoming very random. The worst thing for an organization, if there are multiple cooks in the kitchen or multiple points of power centers. And you've got to be careful to not create that dynamic. So you have to work through the CEO, yet you have to engage with the organization in a broader sense to make sure you understand, have a sense, finger on the pulse and sense of what's going on. And so it's a very, very fine balance, and I'm learning.
And is there a difference to the way you process the opportunities that come your way? For example, one is sort of looking at opportunities to be an executive leader as you're going through your career. But once you transition from that phase to evaluating board opportunities, in your mind, what are the 3-4 questions people should ask?
Oh, before they take up a board.
They take up a board position.
I think the single biggest thing you have to look at is the value system of the organization and the people at the top. Okay, if it's a promoter-based driven company, then, you know, are you comfortable with the value system? Because at the end of the day, you have a fiduciary responsibility. You are legally liable. And so you want to make sure that you're happy with that. The second thing you have to ask yourself is, why do they want me? Am I just, you know, ticking the box in some aspect of diversity?
Yeah.
Or are they genuinely interested and open and welcoming of the experience and perspectives I'll be bringing? Because it's very frustrating if you're just tick box and they really don't want you, and you figure it out after the fact. Can be quite, you have to ask yourself, do I really like the CEO and the chair? Because they are the two most powerful figures in the boardroom. Okay? And a lot of the dynamic is shaped by these two individuals. So you've got to feel comfortable with the chemistry with these two people. Because otherwise you struggle mightily, both around your emotions as well as the ability to have impact and influence of things. And finally, you've got to be thoughtful about, how am I going to add value?
Right.
Okay. And it's not always obvious. Most of the time, you add value during moments of crisis. In peacetime, things are just trucking along and there's not much to do. It's the difference between a peacetime general and a wartime general, or a peacetime army and a wartime army. So you have to think through sharply the ways in which you're going to make a difference.
And in your mind, we briefly spoke about competencies of a good leader. In your mind, what are the 2-3 must-haves to be a great board member? Again, what's that delta which differentiates the great board members from the average?
I think first is commitment. If you're taking this on, take it seriously. Read the material they send you. Be intensely present during the meeting and discussions rather than checking, you know, your email or reading your iPad. I see a lot of board members not 100% engaged. Because only if you're engaged can you really have insight. So that's just so obvious, but I mention it. The second thing is, I think the most important thing, way in which you make a difference, is by asking the right question at the right moment in the right way. The most effective board members I've seen over the years are those who are able to articulate that perfect question that was on everybody's mind, but it didn't get expressed, and this person and precipitates it, and then the whole conversation just stops, and then everybody gravitates to that. And sometimes it can result in very, very, very different decisions and so forth. But again, if you're not fully engaged, it's hard to do. A third important thing is to take on responsibilities. So, you know, attending the board meeting is just one part of it. So being active on board committees, chairing a board committee, whether it's audit or investment committee or whatever it is, I think is important, because committees is where the work happens. And that's what gives you influence in discussions. These would be a few things.
Just a last question, Ravi, before I move to a few quick questions to wrap up. You've been successful in two long stints in Cummins and Microsoft, and now you move to a portfolio approach in how you've gone about taking responsibilities. How should, as we move towards a world driven by marketplaces and gigs, how should people think about, you know, being a freelancer? I use it in a very loose way, but committing to one organization versus committing to a portfolio of opportunities. How should people think about how they architect their careers?
First, I think it's important. I think it's a super question, by the way. I don't think I have a great answer. Let me give it a shot. I think you have to first know yourself. There are some people who are more adventurous, more restless, whatever. I think naturally you'll do better doing multiple things. Okay, there are others who, you know, our personality is such that we like stability, we like, you know, being part of a community, whatever. You tend to veer towards more stable, traditional structures, even though those may be becoming slightly fewer or much more turbulent themselves. In the beginning of my career, I was probably more inclined towards deep roots. Over time, I changed. And so I made changes. I think there is a certain joy when I reflect in being with an organization for a long, where you're in harmony with the values and the leadership for a long period of time. I still think my best years professionally were 16 years at Cummins Engine Company. It was a fabulous place with a culture that and values that I resonated with, where I respected the chairman and CEO, and they had a lot of time for me. And they were incredibly caring, in the sense of even paying for my parents' hospitalization at Mayo Clinic, etc. You know, it was truly the old-fashioned, paternalistic. Yeah, and it was easy to be loyal to them in return. I think if you can find such moments, cherish them. The chances are it's going to be rarer and rarer in a world that is transactional. And therefore, yeah, don't look for that necessarily. If you find it, cherish it, enjoy it. But otherwise, get used to standing on your own feet and making your contribution and finding the other things that you want, community, relationships, all those things in other spheres, which don't necessarily have to look for everything in your workplace.
True.
Okay.
And just picking up on the term transactions, I think if I were to reflect on it, transaction costs have come down given technology, given connectivity. And the whole notion of the theory of the firm, I think, is evolving as we move towards a more of a interconnected world where a lot of things can be done through an ecosystem. So again, I guess in a lot of ways, today it's probably gotten a lot easier for people to cobble that portfolio together and replicate what makes sense for them.
Yeah, I think the pendulum will swing. It is still swinging in the direction of more and more virtual organizations.
Right.
Okay, where more and more people are free agents and they come together around task. But that's not how human beings are built. You know, as they say, man is a social animal. So we need relationships. We enjoy commitment. For all, you know, hunting, we were successful because we hunted in groups.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to bring down bigger animals. And I think that instinct has not gone away. And therefore, organizations which actually still try to create these bonds, which are loyal to their employees, not in an old-fashioned paternalistic guaranteed lifetime employment, but in terms of investing in people, being a meritocracy, giving them ample runways for growth and development, are going to be able to attract disproportionately special people and deliver superior performance. One of the problems in this lower and lower transaction costs idea is at some point, trust also deteriorates. And then the transaction cost curve starts going up, going back up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
So,
discovering,
if people don't trust each other, then the transaction cost to establish trust will also start rising. So I think we're reaching a point where there may be that the inflection where it starts climbing again. And then we'll have to find some new equilibrium. So I'm completely not in agreement with those who say we're going to head to this completely virtual world where everybody's a free agent bound together only by marketplaces and technology. That's not how humans behave.
It's very interesting you say this. If I were to relate to a metaphor from a different space, I was talking to a friend of mine who heads strategy for a large publisher. And I asked him, given that people are discovering information through net, is your business at risk? And his point was at some point the pendulum would swing back because people need to trust the information source.
So if you notice all the debate around the US right now, it's about fake news. Okay? So everything that you read on the internet isn't necessarily true. Therefore, something like the New York Times or the Washington Post, the Economist, with FT, which curates, is going to become more reliable again. BBC will be more trusted again. So I think we should beware of a world of, you know, which is completely transactional, where everything is free, where there's no value to, you know, humanness or humanity. I think that will be an inherently unstable phase and you'll have the pendulum swing back.
Yeah. Lovely. Ravi, I want to move to a few quick fire questions before we wrap up. Three things they don't teach at business school.
Well, they don't teach the importance of teams and choosing good people. I don't think there's enough of a premium put on becoming reflective. Why am I here? You know, what does, you know, how am I going to define success and the quest for that? Third one, very simple one, is probably not enough emphasis on execution. So a lot on ideas and conceptual stuff.
One piece of advice that stuck with you?
One of my early bosses had a saying, two sayings actually, which I'll remember. One, those who work for you will determine how far you go more than those you work for. Your team will determine how far you go more than your boss. So you better pick your team carefully. It was a very sort of powerful thing which I stayed with. The second thing he also said was, you need to participate in your own rescue, which is, yeah, sure, we can all come and help you, but you need to, you know, be open and ready and do the most.
Yes.
And so don't just lie there like a victim. There's no place for victimhood. Yeah, both were pretty powerful. Same guy.
Who is this?
Huh? A guy called Kevin Turner.
And three leaders you look up to who've been big influences?
On my life?
Yeah.
I've got to say, Narayan Murthy.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think he's just one of the most amazing entrepreneurs and people, and yeah, I really have put him heads and shoulders above most people. Second would be Bill Gates, particularly for his ability to completely reinvent himself and, you know, not hold on but move on and tackle big problems of our times. Who else would it be? A person I never met, but I think most people, many people are influenced by, is Gandhiji. Sort of a family connection too, but it's hard not to be influenced by the man and his thinking. Very poor answers, but it's the truth.
Sure. And finally, if you had to put together a board of directors for yourself, who would you put on that board, and who would be the chairman?
Mine would be a big board, because I really do learn from a lot of people, and I use a lot of people as sort of a sounding board. And it's not all famous, recognizable names. My wife would be on it. Sonali is a very sound person, and I trust her common sense and judgment a lot. It's a very large list. Like, so if you need names.
I think I'm just curious about how you think about having a network of people around you who influence your trajectory.
So over the years, when I encounter a person whose point of view seems distinctive and sharp and interesting, and I believe that they fundamentally have my good interests at heart, and therefore I can trust them, they automatically get filed into this category of future director. Okay. And there's probably about 20, 25 people whose judgment I trust intent I trust on very different things. So somebody I'll consult on a professional matter. Okay. Somebody else will consult on a personal decision. And so it's a fairly surprisingly long list.
Exciting. Lovely. Ravi, thank you so much for your time. Pleasure talking to you. You've been very generous with your time.
Not at all. I just wish I could have done a better job answering your most sort of thoughtful questions.
Not at all. Thank you.
The one thing that was a big takeaway for me in this conversation was the notion of self-awareness. That often is the one differentiating factor that separates the long-term winners from the short-term winners, who could often get away with sheer smarts and drive in the early years. This showed up at multiple places in the conversation, whether it was founders dealing with a growing organization, executives transitioning from executive to a non-executive role, transitioning across industries, and so on. Self-awareness often lies at the center of a lot of other people-related competencies that start to matter as people gain tenure and become more senior. Unfortunately, that doesn't get taught anywhere and is often left to chance. Thank you for listening. Hope you found the conversation purposeful. Look forward to having you at a subsequent conversation at the Play to Potential podcast series. Bye now.